Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Today, we jump into President Donald Trump's current call for the elimination of early voting in all American elections. He wants to limit voting to in-person voting on Election Day in preparation for the midterm elections in 2026. Judge Gail, this is a mess.
It is.
Let me start off by saying that, and we're getting contradictory messages. So let me just set the stage just a bit. It's estimated that 30% of people who voted in 2024 did so by mail-in ballots. If you add to that the people who voted early at various polling places, that number is well over half and is staggering. The Republicans in many states are saying, we need to jump on this. Normally, this has been historically, it was a Republican thing to mail in ballots because the Republicans were older. They had less mobility to the polls. But then that fell away. Democrats sort of took it over. Now it's a Democratic thing. But Republicans are around the country saying, we need to juice this up. We need to boost our pre-election voting or pre-election day voting. But then the President Trump says, no, we don't want to do that. Instead, we want to have no early voting. It's really confusing.
I think that's an understatement. And so I just think about all of the different issues that are raised with just this single statement. Right. And we can kind of take them. And I think you can add to this list as we go. But I wanted to throw out a couple things I'd like for us to address as we're kind of mining through not just the legality of attempting to ban in-person voting, but the impracticality of attempting to ban in-person voting. And so here are some things I'd just like you to keep kind of a running list of, and I'd like us to walk through them, but also feel free to chime in if my list is not exhaustive. So the first issue is, well, first of all, you know, all elections are not, there are no elections actually. There are zero elections that are purely, exclusively, only federal. Every time there's an election or there's voting, there are often local and or state issues to be determined.
Right.
And so, you know, the idea that the federal government should, you know, come in and control how those local and or state elections that are all on the same ballot, by the way, take place is what we call in the law, at least in my view, what we call ultra vires, which is outside the reach.
There you go with your Latin again.
Outside the reach of the federal government. So we can come back to that and we can touch on that some more. But I'm like, in what universe is a ballot only a federal election ballot? That just doesn't happen. And so we have the issue of state sovereignty. And then in addition to that, if this were to become the reality that I would be just in awe if it ever did. The level of disenfranchisement of certain voters would just be thunderstriking. Everyone from our military members, who are often not just out of state, but out of the country. They're often out of their home state or their domicile state. So, you know, they can't show up in person to vote, especially when their duty is to protect us, you know, abroad, and heck, apparently now even here, but that's a whole nother issue. What about, you know, our mature voters? Some people call them elderly. I'd prefer to call them mature.
are mature voters who find that their mobility is limited. What if you are in a nursing home? If you are in a care facility, whether you are mature or not, right? You have, you know, a mobility limitation. What about college students or those American citizens who are just physically situated in a foreign environment on election day? The breadth of disenfranchisement, just the temptation to do that is just, it would be thunder striking to me. The other thing is there are actual states, I believe Oregon's one of them, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Judge, but there are certain states that only provide for mail-in voting. Like there is no in-person voting at all. And this goes back.
Oregon, Washington, and Utah.
There you go. And Utah, by the way, folks, is a red state. You have Oregon and Washington state and Utah who they only provide for voting by mail-in. And that speaks to the sovereignty of the states to conduct the elections in the manner that they choose, even when there are federal issues on the ballot. You know, who's the federal government to go in and tell them that they have to revert back to a different form of voting that they apparently have seen work just fine for them for however long that they've had it? Not to mention there are lots of hybrid states, right? States that provide for early voting and in-person voting at the same time, Ohio being one of them. I think Massachusetts. I don't know that there's a state that only permits in-person voting. I just don't know that that exists anymore.
In-person voting on election day.
In-person vote. And so then we narrowed it even more. In-person voting only on election day during the hour.
That's what Trump is calling for.
This sounds like the antebellum South, but it sounds absolute banana. It sounds like a poll tax. It sounds like, you know, disenfranchising people from accessing the voting polls. And you will not be able, given the participation in voting, I think you would overwhelm a system in order to get that done. But that's the third issue, is the states that have mail-in only voting. The fourth thing, and I think it speaks to something you said in the intro, which is how Republicans had for a very long time kind of owned the market on early voting, on banking votes, getting them in, and you know, not relying on election day, but instead kind of training their voters to do this. And
then those old white-haired Republican voters to the polls through the mail.
Absolutely. And many of them are still older and whiter haired and have become reliant on that system in order to continue to exercise the franchise. What I believe happened was that there was a clear, like, flip of the switch, at least in the most recent era. And that was with the election of President Barack Obama. If he did nothing, he really did encourage voters to, quote, bank their votes, right? Which is what early voting is bank your vote, bank your vote. And that made all the difference. From being a community organizer to becoming the president of the United States, he really did parlay those skill sets very well. And I think part of this might actually be a backlash to the success of that and how Democrats have really seized upon that moving forward, whether it's with voter registration drives, souls to the polls, getting individuals out to vote, providing rides and ride sharing to get to the polls. Just became popular.
Yeah, it became popular. And then we can't forget toss in COVID.
Yes.
And the 2020 presidential election.
And it became necessary then.
Figures showed that nearly 70% of votes cast for president in 2020 were sent in by mail or during early voting periods.
Wow.
In 2024 presidential election, mail access to ballots was expanded, and we still had 60% with a majority of people sending in mail ballots or voting prior to election day. So that's 70% during the COVID crisis and 60% 4 years later afterwards, showing how entrenched this is.
Precisely. So in both instances, you have well north of half of the population.
Yeah.
Engaging this well north. This isn't like even within margin of error north. This is just very, very, this is far north. This is like the U.S.-Canada border far north,
yeah,
of the population engaging this. And I think the last point, again, I'm going to make, and I'm going to invite you to touch on any one of these, is just rank hypocrisy. The very individual and individuals calling for this are often folks who themselves have voted by mail and have engaged and utilized this to engage the franchise. And
like the president himself.
Yes. And for whom there was no complaint when they did it. And again, it's fine as long as the outcome is the outcome apparently or seemingly that they desire. But this is really just rank hypocrisy, because there was never a challenge to this when this same system was being utilized by them. There was no question, no issue or concern as to whether or not this system or this process was fair, if it was protected, if it, you know, provided appropriate access, if there were appropriate safeguards in place to ensure that the elections are free and fair and appropriate. Never a question. It only became that, again, at a time when all of us were navigating a global pandemic, the likes of which we had, at least in our lifetimes, never seen, and were really trying to figure out how we could keep all of Americans' protections in place and accesses in place and with very few or little disturbances. And because the outcome wasn't, you know, to the liking of, you know, one or some candidates, then it now the eye has turned to the system as a whole, as opposed to just the fact that perhaps you just didn't like the outcome.
Let me jump in here and add another one to your list of concerns, and that is that this is all a strategy to bring into question the results of the 2026 midterm elections.
Or continuation, right?
Whether there is power or not, this is Trump laying the groundwork to say that the elections were rigged because of this fact. Let's go back to the first issue that you talked about, and that is the power. Back in August was the first time that Trump really talked about this, and he, of course, did it through social media, showing that he really had not given up on his 2020 election fraud theories that had shown to be unproven.
He's not going to be happy until he's vindicated.
But he said that he wanted the Justice Department to pursue looking at all of these scandals surrounding early voting. So that's one thing he did. Now, does he have power to do that? That's questionable, but let's give him that fact. The second thing he said he was going to do was to issue an executive order banning mail-in ballots or pre-election day in-person voting. As you pointed out, Judge Gale, the states are not mere agents of the federal government here.
Indeed.
The states are in control of the election process. If you look at the Constitution, really the only area that Congress or the federal government has any jurisdiction over is congressional elections. That's it. Not even the presidential elections. Those are all up to the states. So The Congress may mandate a certain way that Congress people are elected, but that's all. And certainly that's not the intent of Trump when he wants to eliminate these forms of voting. So does he have the power? Every legal expert that I've looked at on this issue says no, he doesn't.
Actually, they say hell no.
Yeah,
but
the states,
no.
the states have the power, and he can't do anything in this area by executive order. He may make an executive order. He may tout an executive order. He may say that the executive order is effective, but the executive order would have no power to change the election process in the states. Period.
No force or effect. And by the way, I think, you know, the Department of Justice has just become kind of the, you know, one of the nation's boogeymen, right? It is, I'm just going to unleash the Department of Justice and have them use the full weight of the government to quash in-person voting. And I don't think you get to the end goal that is desired here any better, any quicker, or with any more force or effect than an ineffective and unenforceable executive order. And quite frankly, at the rate we appear to be going with the purging of Department of Justice staff, in a minute, they're going to have to deputize a couple janitors to walk in court and handle these cases, because I don't know if anybody's actually going to be left working at the U.S. Department of Justice, given, you know, again, how the career prosecutors are being purged. And even if they weren't purged, I don't know that their professional opinions are being taken to heart, because apparently or seemingly, if you disagree, you know, disagreement leads to firing. And if you provide that very thoughtful advice to your client, meaning if you tell the executive and you tell the heads of the department that this is a failed effort and we do not have the legal authority to attempt to quash or to claw back the rights of voters to vote, you know, in whatever manner the state proscribes, then that could very well lead to demotion or firing merely by giving appropriate advice to your client. And this is, again, just another one of those, you know, mind-blowing examples of what's happening here in what appears to be, you know, the use of either the executive power, which, thanks to the Supreme Court having, you know, vested so much authority in the executive, I think there's now the sense that, you know, the executive can do whatever they choose, and they can do it almost by fiat through executive order. And
by
doing that, you have, they don't even have to exercise, the executive doesn't have to exercise internal reins or internal controls, because they, you know, essentially feel like they've been vested with the supreme and ultimate power to do even this, where, like you said, every legal expert, and I'm not suggesting that I'm one of those legal experts, I'm just saying from a very pedantic standpoint, from just a state's rights standpoint, there seems to be quite a bit of daylight that has been enumerated in the Constitution that says this is not the purview of the federal government to decide, but rather states in their sovereignty decide on their own terms how, if and when, time, place, and manner to, you know, issue elections. And the only thing that's governing the federal elections is when it has to happen, that, you know, that first Tuesday in November. That is the only thing. But absent that, there is no role for the federal government to dictate to a state, you know, how time, place, and manner, other than time, you know, place and manner of issuing and managing their elections.
We talk about mobility of people, and Trump seems to be at odds with his own party. And let me set this up. He sent out a tweet He sent out on Truth Social. And this is what he said. Watch how totally dishonest the California prop vote is. Millions of ballots being shipped, Trump said. Get smart, Republicans, before it's too late. Now, that was his message. He demanded the same day voting on paper ballots was the only way to do this. Now,
and next it'll be what? Hand counting them and using an abacus instead of a calculator?
Basically, through that message, he told California voters not to vote on this issue that's going to reapportion California, not to cast their votes early or by mail. That was exactly the opposite message that Republican officials in California were trying to get to their voters, saying, use this, do it, build that, you know, people with mobility issues, use it, do it. And now, get this, you know, more than 4 million mail-in ballots, more than 18% sent to the state's 23 million voters have already been returned as of last week, some 2 to 3 weeks prior to the election. You know, he's spitting in the wind here.
But can you raise a really important point about spitting in the wind, but also the mixed messaging and the folly potentially of mixed messaging. Consider the fact that, as you said, in California, you have the Republican leadership that's actually encouraging their base, their voters, whether they're Republicans or independents that lean Republican or people who can be persuaded to vote the way that they prefer on the reapportionment issue. Consider the fact that they're receiving one message from inside the state and another one from national, right? And imagine what happens if that cadre of voters, which could, you know, total into the millions, imagine if that cadre of voters decided that they would instead follow the national voice as opposed to perhaps the state and local voice, and they're not going to return their mail-in ballot. They're not going to vote early. And we've seen this happen across the board. And either they can't vote or they have to vote provisionally because they've been issued a ballot. So you want to make sure they don't vote twice by returning their ballot and now showing up at the polls, because that could lead to concern for voting. But with proper tools in place, you can actually vet that out. You know, this is amazing that this is an administration that leans really heavily into crypto, AI, and the like. And yet when it comes to, you know, improving the sophistication of voting systems and processes, it's like all of a sudden, no. You know, we don't trust it for that, but I do trust it for banking. I trust it with my money, but I don't trust it with my vote. That just seems that seems odd to me. What's more is consider the fact that a lot of the people that may be relied upon to vote early will never be able to make it to the polls on election day.
Never.
They will never get there. And so essentially what it turns into,
some of them are old, some of them are infirm,
yes,
some of them have to work.
Yes, it turns into voter suppression of your
care.
Own people.
Yeah.
it is voter suppression of your own people. Because remember, this is also a Congress that is not in favor of giving workers day off, whether it's government workers or anybody else. So there is no, hey, there is no, you know, national holiday of voting, right? There's no requirement that an employer give you election day off.
Here in Massachusetts, everything closes on election day. Schools, everything.
Yeah, not here in Ohio.
No,
I can tell you
know.
That. And also that, and what Massachusetts is an anomaly, because
yes,
that is,
it is.
That is not the case nationwide. And so again, I'm looking at this and I'm like, okay, not only is there mixed messaging, so you're potentially confusing your voting base, but in addition to that, you may very well be actively disenfranchising your own base because of their clear inability to comply with the now very strict standard of voting that you're purporting should, you know, we should turn the clock back to and return to. This isn't a time when we're talking about paper ballots that I guess potentially will be hand counted. Because imagine if you got the paper ballots that are being counted by machines, and all of a sudden there will be, you know, some, you know, suggestion that the machines are being taken over by a foreign entity, and the votes are being padded. So now you have to have, you can only trust the human beings, and only certain human beings by that, at that point, only certain human beings can actually do the actual tallying and counting. This is just exhausting to think about this as the potentiality for 2026.
Well, look what's happening here, though, Judge Gale. Let's just look politically for a moment. I know we talk legal matters, but let's look politically. What he's doing is raising the specter that California, and a lot of people will believe him, that California's issue to redistrict the state, to add more Democrats, to basically gerrymander their own state in favor of Democrats, is going to be rigged. It's going to be invalid. He's raising that specter, even though it's cross-messaging with his own party, he's raising that specter to put that issue in question. All of this leads up to putting the 2026 midterms in question, piece by piece by piece. Now, not only is he doing that in California, but in New York City, where Zoran Mandami is running for mayor against Andrew Cuomo, Curtis Sliwa, I believe it's pronounced, S-L-I-W-A. Mm-hmm. Right now, they had early voting, and New York had 164,000 voters came to the first day of early voting. That's five times higher than the first weekend of early voting 4 years ago. Now, it's gaining popularity, but Trump sees this as a way to question the vote in California, to question the mayoral vote in New York, which he hates Mamdani and wants him not to be mayor, has threatened to deport him if he gets elected. This is a trend, and it's building up to 2026. That's what it is. It's not on the merits. It's based on pure politics.
And it really is. And as it relates to the mayoral race in New York, it smacks of racism.
Well, yeah.
And that's another undercurrent. But at the same time, to your point, I think it is important to note, yes, that the messaging perhaps is designed to raise that specter of we can't trust the outcome if it isn't in our favor. And that's essentially what the messaging is. If it doesn't break our way, then there had to be something untoward that happened. So don't trust it. I think, though, that the recipients or the people most likely to receive that messaging favorably and respond to it are the people that are already really tuned into this type of rhetoric and messaging.
The conspiracy theories of elections?
Yeah, I don't know I would like to believe that audience of folks listening to this is not growing. It may be maintaining, but it's not growing. So think of California. I mean, is there anybody, if you have watched elections, even national elections, I don't know, in the last half century, we all know that California gets called minutes after the polls close. Why? Because there's just a clear trend line and understanding of how California swings, right? If you right. only watch the most recent national elections with the Trump Harris race, literally after the California polls closed, California was called for then Vice President Harris, because
there's just a clear understanding of how California breaks. The state of California as a whole is not one of these, it's not purple at all. I mean, just like the current president knows a red state from a blue state, we don't expect that Oklahoma will turn blue anytime soon. I don't know that kind of calling into question whether or not the reapportionment on the California ballot. And if it passes, I don't know that calling that into question in a state that is about as blue can be is really a winning argument. Again, but for, as you said, the idea of constantly trying to reinforce that messaging that this is rigged, there's cheating.
Yeah, it's a national audience.
Yeah, if they win, it's because they've cheated. And what I think you want is just to remind people you are talking about California, folks. I mean, it's like, you know, saying hippies didn't smoke weed.
Yeah,
come on, really? I mean, everybody knew that that was the case. Everybody knows what the case is in California. Even when it comes to New York, similarly speaking, this is another one of those things. Now, Andrew Cuomo has historically been a Democrat. It's interesting that he's aligned with the current administration, but historically he's been a Democrat and he's seeking to re-enter elected office. And for those who are in any way attuned to what's happening in New York, it seems particularly curious that the current mayor, Mayor Adams, who was running, you know, a very strong race as an independent in New York, has recently decided to bow out of the race. And the suspicion is that Andrew Cuomo would then enjoy what we call vote transfer, or the transfer of support from Mayor Adams to former Governor Cuomo, which may or may not happen. And with so many people voting early in New York, it seems that notwithstanding the messaging out of D.C., the New York voters are making their position very clear. When you said that, you know, now there is kind of this increased participation in early voting, there is a driver behind that. There's something driving that. And either it's because people have so bought into the rhetoric of, I'm going to make sure this is not a rigged election, so I'm going to cast my vote early. Or there are people that are saying, I'm so sick of this crap, I'm going to make sure that I don't get caught on election day when something might come up, and I've got to make sure that my voice is heard. So I'm going to do it early, and this is what I'm supporting. It is entirely possible that that's what was happening. And yes, when you have the loudest mic and the biggest bully pulpit, and you have, you know, followers who will will say and do whatever you instruct them to, then I guess there are folks in the world who feel like they can use that platform to try to continue to persuade people that what is real is not real and what is not real is real. And I think that's what's happening here, but I don't think that the audience is swelling. I think the audience at best is staying pat.
Well, let me put out a couple of theories, and I want your response, if you would, Judge Gale. Again, I think this is all part of some insidious master plan to call the 2026 midterms into question if they don't go Trump's way. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's calling into question the new gerrymandering referendum in California, the mayor position in New York, which, you know, he calls the mayoral, leading mayoral candidate a communist, and like I said, threatened to deport him if elected, cut off all federal funds to New York City. That's another threat. You combine this, Judge Gale, with the troops he's sending out now to Portland, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Memphis, the list goes on, California. And you add in the Insurrection Act, which President Trump keeps threatening to use to call out even more military, not National Guard, but regular military troops. And I see a threat to the 2026 midterms. either a threat that he will say that the country's in such crisis and elections are so rigged that he will try to halt the elections, or that he will question every single win that the Democrats would get, especially if they would take the majority in the House. Mm-hmm. I see all of this as a step by step by step, drip, drip, drip process leading up to the goal of the 2026 elections. Because frankly, if he loses the House, he's in trouble. And he knows that, and his handlers know that. And so they're trying to build what they did after the election in 2020, they're trying to now build before the elections in 2026 by using theories like no pre-election day voting.
I think you're so right. And I think not only does this go to the concern you raised about strategy, long-term strategy for 2026, which, by the way, I think we both agree that the Republican Party has mastered the long game. That
yes,
they have been forward thinking. If you can think about the fact that, you know, for the longest, you know, and former AG Eric Holder, who has been kind of ringing the gerrymandering alarm for a long, long time, has said, hey, we need to be thinking about this. And at the same time, you had predominantly blue states that were saying, you know, we got to be the good guys. We need to make sure people know we want to do this fairly and we want to do this appropriately. So you had scores of blue states. Well, not scores. You had enough blue states who passed legislation to establish independent commissions to determine the congressional districts in those states. Again, these are blue states. And meanwhile, you had a lot of red states like, we're not getting on that bandwagon. We don't have any interest. We're just going to leave it the way it is, which is why now we're sitting in 2025. And now look at the landscape. You have an executive who's literally able, in many regards, to literally pick up the phone and contact governors in red states where there are no independent commissions, by the way, and simply say, hey, you know what? Rework that map and give us X amount of seats. We need to be able to pick up some seats. How is it so easy? Well, you can have a governor call the legislature back into session, rework the map. If there's, you know, a certain party that is in control, then it becomes kind of an easy win. While at the same time, for all of those blue Democratic states who were very on the bandwagon of ensuring that this is done fairly, appropriately, at the right time, and they're therefore established commissions to do it, are finding themselves kind of behind the eight ball, even in trying to respond. So that to me is just kind of how this checkers versus chess thing is kind of playing out, is, you know, trying to be the good guy actually puts you at a disadvantage when the bad guys kind of, or when the other guys, bad or otherwise, I mean, I think they're good folks on both sides. They're bad folks on both sides. But when the other guys try to rework the rules, and you have now hampered yourself and your ability to be able to respond by, or at least limited yourself and your ability to be able to respond, because what? You thought you were doing good. You were wearing a white hat when you said, hey, we're going to establish these commissions. The other thing is, I just don't think that on balance, there is an entire population of citizens who do not see what's happening. And so, yes, you can have an executive that calls foul in advance for what they are apparently afraid of the outcome of the California election to be. I think, however, California and Governor Newsom has done a good job of making it very clear in their messaging that this is in direct response to what Texas did first. And so California would respond to Texas. Well, that has since been followed by multiple other states who have and are, you know, considered red states, who have since called their legislators back into session to do very similar to what Texas did, North Carolina being one of them. And therefore, there is this race, if you will, to try to counterbalance what may be coming down the pipe in 2026. And I don't think people are, I think, yes, there are those who are just sold out. They will believe anything that is told to them and they will mindlessly follow. But I do believe that there is a good chunk of the electorate. And I think largely maybe even the independents, not the folks that are like diehard on one side or another, but it's that growing swath of voters that's right in the middle, the independents, who clearly see it for what it is. If there's any effort to rig the election, it's all these people in these states that have traditionally swung red that are now looking to be disenfranchised because now their congressional districts are being redrawn so as to provide what is perceived to be an advantage to one side versus another in a year when it otherwise wouldn't happen. People aren't stupid. They absolutely understand. And they probably, like you and I, see this as a panicked response. This is, oh my God, this is, you know, we could actually lose this thing. So we need to do everything we can to kind of redraw this and increase our chances of holding on to this power. Because I think any normal person would say, if all things remained equal and folks genuinely believe that this could be a fair fight, fair election without all of these machinations and changes, then you would let the chips fall where they may and you wouldn't worry so much about what the outcome is. You just continue to govern. But it is because there's a certain side that's trying to kind of see around the corner and what they're seeing, they don't like. And so what they need to do is try to change the outcome potentially of what around the corner looks like by kind of padding the odds for themselves. And I think voters are not stupid. They see this. And I think some of them, many of them, are just outright repulsed by it. And this is not, I don't think this is by mistake. These are folks that, you know, again, may have in the past voted for one side or another. And they're clearly seeing what's happening. And they cannot be convinced that this is anything other than pre-election rigging or efforts to rig elections in advance to gain advantages they otherwise would not have. And I think that voters are going to, they're going to respond to this very vocally. They're going to respond at the ballot box. And I don't know that it's going to work out the way folks intended to.
Well, Trump in his Truth Social, again, going back to his words, has asked his Department of Justice to investigate the outcome of the 2020 election with gusto. And again said it was the biggest scandal in American history. And the only way to keep that from happening again is to eliminate early voting. Now, this is exactly what he said. Look what happened to our country when a crooked moron became our president. We now know everything. I hope the DOJ pursues this with as much gusto as befitting the biggest scandal in American history. If not, it will happen again, including the upcoming midterms. No mail-in or early voting. Yes to voter ID. Now, I love Gavin Newsom's response to that. Gavin Newsom put a message on X, formerly Twitter, saying, "Ramblings of an old man that knows he's going to lose." but that's, again, setting the stage.
Or based, he could have said, "Does that mean you too, sir?"
Based on 2020 and his claim that he really won the 2020 election, he's bringing that up. He's having the Justice Department investigate the biggest scandal in American history and using that as a precursor to bringing 2026 into question. I don't know that we'll even have midterm elections in 2026, Judge Gale. I wish I didn't have to say that, but I am not convinced that he will allow those elections to go forward.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with the consternation and the fear and concern. Here's what I'll say, though, is, so this kind of brings us back to why we do what we do. I am encouraged that at least to this point, the trial courts have been very forcefully responsive.
I agree, but the appellate courts are split.
The appellate courts are split. But I also believe at the heart and the core of this, that even for as disappointed as we've been in our U.S. Supreme Court, I genuinely believe that this Supreme Court, and it may not be everyone, I'm not calling no names, you know who you are, you know why we look at you skeptically and we raise an eyebrow, but I genuinely believe that this Supreme Court may completely understand how this will absolutely cause this this democracy, this country, this union to tear asunder. And that, and just like we were able to navigate voting during the height of the coronavirus pandemic, we can get through, yes, even an executive who is at least attempting to use the power of the U.S. Department of Justice, the strongest law enforcement agency the world has ever seen, against presumably or in essence against its own people, I think we will have a U.S. Supreme Court that finally says, you know what? And they may never say, hey, look, you know what? We bleeped up when we, you know, issue that one opinion and decision that kind of gave a lot of power to certain somebody who didn't really need it and shouldn't have it. And that means everybody after that will have it. So we can't really curtail it. But when it comes to this, this is a basic fundamental right that we, that constitutionally cannot be suspended because of the fears or whims of a single individual. Even if that single individual has a lot of followers, I think we'll finally see a Roberts Court, you know, actually respond to what is. And I think they've been seeing the handwriting on the wall, quite frankly. But I think we see a Roberts Court that will finally say, hey, you know what? We kind of created part of this monster. So we've got a real part of this in. And there's, you know, we've painted ourselves into this corner. And now we got to figure out, you know, either how we're going to get out or how we're going to have wet paint on our shoes, because we're going to have to walk across this corner we just painted ourselves into.
I wish I had your confidence in this Supreme Court. I don't. I look at Alito and Thomas and Roberts and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett. Those six have unleashed a presidency without guardrails. There are no guardrails on this president. This is the same Supreme Court, Judge Gale, that, you know, has gutted and continues to gut the Voting Rights Act.
That is true.
So, you know, they don't seem to give a damn about people's right to vote. So why would they care about this? That's my cynical view. I could be talked out of it if you want to give me some reasons, but I just don't see it. I see this Supreme Court as saying, okay, we gave you unlimited power within the official acts of the presidency, and that's exactly what they did in Trump versus United States. Mm-hmm. So if this is within your power, then you have that power. The only thing that I could see this court might do is say that elections are not within your power.
Well, and that's truth. So, okay.
But you know, they gave pretty well unlimited breadth to the, you know, what was an official act of the president. So the only way that he could do it, and this is, again, my conspiracy theory, is that if he could say that there's a national emergency, issue the Insurrection Act, bring in troops, then he could say it's within my presidential power to halt this election. Response?
I
you think I'm crazy.
And no, I don't. I want to just remain optimistic. And that's why I love the dichotomy of this, because you were just like, I'm just realistic. And I'm like constantly trying to find the bright side here. And I am really optimistic that at the end of the day, that we'll have a Supreme Court that says bridge too far. This is a bridge too far. This is, you know, in deferring to the executive branch.
We keep waiting for that, don't we?
This was not the intention of the court to essentially abdicate all responsibilities, both in the court and Congress, to the executive branch, and essentially infuse the executive branch with, you know, king-like or, you know, deity-like powers. Because it's not king-like powers, more of a deity of sorts.
I wish I could be that optimistic.
That's why you have me.
Yeah, I know. You're a light of sunshine in the dark and gloom in which I sit.
We're going to stay optimistic. And the reason is because you're right. The appellate courts have been split. The trial courts are like, you're killing us. And I think the trial courts are even, you know, yelling up to the Supreme Court, like, hey, you know, just because you're there doesn't make all of us idiots. Our interpretation of the law as we see it, and as we're experiencing it, you know, first of all, shouldn't be subject to review based on, you know, whether you're substituting your judgment for ours, you know, based on the facts. It really should be focused on the law. And if we're focusing on the law and a pure review of the law, then, you know, remember, you got trial court judges that are issuing 100-page
I was going to say 150-page opinion. You ever thought of the trial judge doing that?
These are trial court judges that are issuing novels. I mean, literally, they are like, hey, listen, we will be thorough. We will be clear. We will make a record. Our rationale will not be subject to, you know, substitution by some other place, or the fact the suggestion that we were silent as to important issues. They are issuing very well-reasoned opinions. And I, you know what, I think part of it for the trial court is kind of like what we would do as practitioners, right? Make a record, make a record, make a record. Yeah. And I think that's what the trial court is continuing to do. They are making a record to say, not just to the appellate court, but actually ultimately to the Supreme Court, this is no plaything. Take into consideration that this takes a lot of time. I mean, most trial court judges don't have the luxury of time to write 100-plus page opinions, and yet they are doing it to say, we are making a record because you cannot keep missing the signals here.
But Judge Gale, for our listeners, I think the trial judges also are framing these issues and issuing these mammoth opinions to lock the Supreme Court into dealing with the issue at hand.
Yes.
And not dealing with some side issue of procedure that could have them avoid making a decision. They are framing it so the Supreme Court will go up or down on the law and not some side issue.
And they are making them focus, and you're right. And this is because, for the benefit of our listeners, this is because the Supreme Court has traditionally sidestepped important issues by looking to procedure as opposed to substance. And so, yeah, they are saying, you need to focus, you need to decide, you need to make a decision about the legal issue at hand, and not the process. We will handle the process here, and we're going to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. But when it gets to you, this is really going to be, you're going to have to eat this one. You're going to need to say some one way or another, and you're going to have to speak loud and bold. And you're also going to, and I think what they're also saying to some degree is, Supreme Court, you too have a duty to see around corners. You have a responsibility to understand the impact of your decisions and to see around the corner and appreciate what your decision is going to do to the rest of this nation.
But very quickly, for our listeners, it's highly unusual for trial courts and some appellate courts to be giving the Supreme Court direction like this. Usually it's the other way around.
Indeed.
But we have a situation where, as Judge Gale so adequately stated, they're trying to get the Supreme Court to actually deal with the issues, up or down, good or bad, but deal with the issues. And we've had all these decisions, Judge Gale, through the shadow docket where we don't know the court's reasoning. And these judges are saying, if you're going to make a decision on my case, you're going to have to deal with the issue and give good reasons why.
And I don't know that I necessarily blame them for that, because these are, you know, kind of heart of the matter issues that do need ultimate resolution one way or another. And but like, look what happened with Judge Chutkan, right?
Yeah.
When the case went up to the Supreme Court, when it returned to her, it didn't even return with a test that she could apply.
No
guidelines.
It didn't
return with instructions.
No.
It was, hey, it's back to you. Now you take a stab at this. And then when you're done and the attorneys are arguing whether you failed or succeeded, then we'll let you know.
Yeah.
What if you're on the right track? That is so frustrating for a trial court judge who really is like the court of first impression. So they're hearing the evidence for the first time. They're assessing credibility of witnesses for the first time. They are applying the law to the facts. And most of them, most judges don't have the luxury of, again, that of time, because
no,
I don't care how much staff you have. All of us only get 24 hours in a day. And
yeah.
So they don't really often have the luxury of time to be able to craft and deliver these, as you call them, these behemoth or mammoth size opinions. And yet they have found that it is so necessary to do so because of the response that they're seeing and they're receiving from the Supreme Court, that it is really, I think it's also hurting the morale of the judiciary. What do you think?
Oh, I think above all, the judiciary morale is at its lowest ebb right now, because the Supreme Court is showing no leadership, no guidance, no guidelines. It's just making these shadow docket decisions without stating reasons. And it's got to be the ultimate frustration for a trial judge to say, I'm trying to apply the law. You're giving me absolutely no help here. All you're doing is smacking down my early decisions in cases without giving me any reason or any guidance for going forward.
Right. Right. And they're just like, listen, I'm not unwilling to follow the guidance, but you're not even given any.
So my advice at this point is to vote by mail, vote early,
yep.
do it while you can.
And just don't vote often, unless it's in a separate election cycle.
I didn't say
but
that.
Yes,
just vote by mail, vote early.
By mail and vote early.
But vote.
Bank your vote. Bank, as in the words of, you know, prior candidates, bank your vote. It is the easiest way to ensure that you don't have any hiccups on election day, because we all know something can happen on election day. So the ability to do that has really been forward thinking on the part of states across this nation, and it has been successful. And one thing we didn't mention that we should, the incidences of alleged voter fraud have been minuscule in comparison to the successes of early voting. So utilize the franchise. The one thing you could really cheat yourself on is your right to engage your democracy on your terms through using the vote. Use your vote.
Judge, we're out of time. Tell people how they can find us.
Well, I am so excited to tell you all, actually, first, thank you for continuing to tune in to Next Witness, Please. You can check us out anywhere you catch your favorite podcasts. We want to give a special thanks and shout out to our primary supporter, that being NPR, National Public Radio. You can catch us on NPR. Just look for Next Witness, Please in the catalog of podcasts there. You can also find us on Spotify, Apple, and Amazon, or again, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. Indeed, our belief is that you don't trust what you don't understand. So our hope is that by tuning in and listening, that we can absolutely increase your understanding with the hope that you'll trust us more.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can always email me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. You can also use that address if you have topics that you would like for us to cover in the future. Just shoot me an email and we'll add your topic to our upcoming list. Next Witness, Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.